My name is Jerry, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast. Learn more about wildebeest. Hello, everybody. So, gotta be honest here, I never thought we're gonna have a real standalone episode just about GNU, about wildebeest. But it makes sense, right? For those of you that have been to Kenya, to Tanzania during the migration time, it's overwhelming. The experiences these things create, how they affect the ecosystem, it's just, it's phenomenal. And it's worth saying that there's more than one kind, right? A wildebeest in South Africa is different to the one in East Africa, and so on and so forth. So in this episode, Donovan and Danny sit down and they unpack pretty much everything to do with wildebeest, from different species and their subspecies to what they eat and what eats them, everything. They talk about the migration, what role this plays on the environment, and it's an animal I think that's mostly overlooked while on safari, but there's way more to them than kind of meets the eye. So grab a cup of coffee, join Danny and Don as they dive into wildebeest. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. I hope everybody's doing well wherever you are listening from. Today, we thought it might be a good idea to speak a little bit about a wildebeest. It's an animal we all see while on safari. And little did Danny know, but I actually pulled her in for this podcast.
This is a very big surprise.
Yeah. So Danny and myself, we're going to speak a little bit more about the species in itself and name a few different things. Like, for example, what is a wildebeest exactly?
Donovan, it's an animal. Are you asking what's a wildebeest?
That's only 2 marks, Danny. And this is a 5 mark question. So Okay. You're only getting 2 marks there. So there's obviously a little bit more than that. We're going to speak about the different species. I guarantee you there's more than you might know. Where you find them, then Danny will also talk a little bit about the migration. And then what do they eat and who eats them and all of that jazz. Danny, are you ready for this?
I'm ready for it. It feels like a test.
Do you like wildebeest?
It's not my favorite animal, no.
I mean, I guess what wildebeest are most famous for is that, apart from the migration, is that they're ugly.
The ugly five.
They're part of the ugly five. And also a lot of people feel that they are just, you know, stupid. not a lot going up in there.
Not enough brain cells.
No. And I guess to some extent, when you look at them and you look at their behavior, I guess you could see where people are coming from.
Mm-hmm. I've realized, do not trust a wildebeest. That is probably...
What made you realize that?
Sitting for hours waiting for them to cross the Mara River. Literally, you sit there and you think, okay, they're going now. And then they stop. And then, okay, they're going now and they stop. Yeah, I've never hated a wildebeest.
Okay, well, Danny, let me put you in their shoes or in their hooves. If you're standing in front of a massive steep bank of river and you can see those 4, 5, 6 meter crocodiles lying below, would you cross that river?
No, but that's why you push someone in first.
Yeah, I guess that's true. No, so a lot of exciting things to unpack in terms of these animals. So let's dive straight into it. Well,
jump.
See what you did there. What is a wildebeest? Well, there's two names for a wildebeest to start off with. It's a wildebeest or a gnu. What do you normally, do you call them wildebeest or gnu more than?
It depends on where I am. Yeah. I think if I'm in South Africa, I say wildebeest. If I'm in Kenya, Tanzania, that side, I'll say gnu.
Yeah, because most people there, like the local Maasai people normally refer to them as gnu.
And have you realized, international guest as well, they'll also refer to it as a gnu rather than a wildebeest.
Yeah.
I think it's wildebeest is such a Afrikaans word.
Yeah, wildebeest.
Wildebeest.
Yeah, which directly translates to wild beast. So that's probably where wildebeest comes in. I see even a lot of South African people don't know exactly how to pronounce it. If it's wildebeest or wildebeest, or a lot of people just don't know how to pronounce it. So I guess it's safer to call them a gnu then. But anyway, so I guess if you could put a definition to the animal, it's basically an animal that looks quite strange with a bulky front and sort of a slender hindquarters that are adapted to walk great distances, climb steep banks. And that's true for the Mara, but they also do climb quite steep terrain in places like South Africa as well. And they mostly dark in color. You get some lighter subspecies, which we'll get into a bit later. And I guess that's what makes up a wildebeest.
Have you ever heard that the little phrase, or I can't really call it a riddle, about the wildebeest?
No.
Why the wildebeest looks like what they look like?
No.
So when they were created, all the spare parts of all the animals were taken and put together. So you have the body of a hyena. You have the face of a giraffe, the horns of a buffalo, the stripes of a zebra. And then, unfortunately, there was no brain cells left. So they just leave that out.
Jeez. Wow. I hope nobody out there describes me as I'm put together as spare parts from humans. That is hilarious. And I haven't heard that, but I can see it, though.
Yeah.
The tail of a horse as
well. The tail of a horse, yeah.
Yeah. That.
Yeah. And they, like how they run.
Mm.
Also very strange.
It is a very
like weird. A little gallopy.
Yeah. It is a different way. It's very, yeah. So it's a strange looking animal. We've got that across. That point has gotten across, I hope. They're still, I guess, what we're trying to get to in this podcast as well is that there's more than meets the eye or reaches the eye with them. You know, there's wildebeest has got, they play a crucial role in the environment. Mm-hmm. They might not know it, but they do play a crucial role, and we'll get to all of that. What I have heard, though, Danny, is that people said that if you could online shop a buffalo and you do it at a cheap online store, you'll get a wildebeest. So, you know, so I have heard that people think that, wildebeest are just a rip-off looking version of a buffalo.
Shame, we should probably stop dishing them.
No, I guess so. But anyway, so the different species of gnu. There's only two. So I said subspecies, and I'm going to put you on the spot there soon, Danny. But the two main species of wildebeest is black wildebeest, or the other name is white-tailed gnu, or blue wildebeest, and that's the second species. The other name is brindled gnu. Mm-hmm. But the blue wildebeest has got five subspecies. Do you know, can you name a few?
Let me try. let's start with southern.
That's correct.
Okay.
It's one.
Eastern
what? It's got a longer name than that.
Eastern white-bearded wildebeest.
There we go. Well done.
That'll help from Donovan there. Western, is it also white-bearded?
There we go.
Okay. Western white-bearded. That's as far as I know.
Yeah, the other two's got some strange names. The one is a Cookson's wildebeest.
Cookson's, okay.
And the last one is a Nyasaland wildebeest. Nyasaland wildebeest.
Okay. Very interesting.
Very, very interesting. Let's unpack these. Let's first unpack the two different species, the black wildebeest and the blue wildebeest. Black wildebeest, it's not something most people that come from, other countries to come on to South Africa for safari would see.
Yes.
Because most people in South Africa that come on safari would go to the eastern parts of South Africa, where the Kruger National Park or the Sabi Sands, Tsimbavati, those kind of areas. Some people might go to Madikwe, which you'll still find the blue wildebeest.
Yeah.
And then some people might go to, northern KwaZulu-Natal, to like Pinda or Shishlui and Mfolozi, those kind of places where you also find the blue wildebeest. Just find the black wildebeest. It's a really specific area. You need to go to the Highveld area. So you need to be like in the Free State or the Karoo. Not the Kalahari, the Karoo. So that's a different desert. Oh, sorry. In South Africa. And or you need to go to places like Swaziland or Lesotho.
Yes.
So what makes them interesting is their horn shape is quite different. So it's of all the wildebeest species, the black and the blue is obviously the different ones, and they look quite different. So the black wildebeest, as their name suggests, they are quite dark in color, like a dark brown. Not. It's funny. They're called black wildebeest.
But they're not black.
They're more brown.
Yes, okay.
The blue wildebeest actually looks a little bit more black.
Okay, but that's actually interesting to find out why are they then called the black wildebeest, because it's like the same with the black rhino.
Yeah.
Why are they called the black
rhino? That's a good question.
Do some research on
that. So the black wildebeest, the first thing that you'll notice when you see them, that's the major difference, is the horn shape. Mm-hmm. So the black wildebeest, their horns point sort of out forwards and then upwards, where the blue wildebeest, their horns go sideways and then up.
Okay.
So there's quite a different structure in their horns. And then obviously another main difference is the black wildebeest has got a white tail and the blue wildebeest has got a black tail.
Okay.
But it's going to be hard to compare these because you can't find them together. They don't live together. There's nowhere where their habitats overlap where you'll find a blue and a black wildebeest together, unless there's some farm that sort of tries and crossbreeds with them. But that's not a natural thing anywhere. Yeah. So naturally, they don't occur in the same areas. So you either find black wildebeest in a reserve or you either find blue wildebeest, but not both. Some other differences is a blue wildebeest, for most parts, they've got these faint stripes on their bodies. Blue wildebeest are also slightly larger than black wildebeest. And black wildebeest, they've got a slightly different social structure. So they are, the males are extremely territorial. So it's very common to find one wildebeest, black wildebeest by itself, waiting for females to come into its little territory and defend them. I've noticed that the common or the southern blue wildebeest do a similar thing, where they've got little middens and territories.
Yeah.
But up in East Africa with the western and the eastern white-bearded wildebeests, they don't really do.
Yeah, it's slightly different.
Slightly different there. So that discusses the differences between the black and the blue. But now let's dive into the blue. We mentioned that there's five different species. And again, we don't have to go into so much detail about what's different to each species, but more about where we find them, because I think that's the more interesting part. They're all still wildebeest, and they look pretty similar. There's a few subtle differences.
Well, the first three that I mentioned is quite, you find them in the south, the west, and the east.
There we go, Danny. As easy as that. So the southern wildebeest you find in southern Africa, but they are also the most widespread.
Yes.
The southern wildebeest, they've got a black beard, they've got black tail, but all of the blue wildebeest have black tails. And then they've got those faint stripes. And you find them in Botswana, South Africa, Mozambique, parts of Zambia, even Namibia. That's where you find the blue wildebeest.
So that's probably the most widespread.
It is.
Wildebeest.
It is the most widespread. It's the most common one, most widespread. So
if they're also called the common wildebeest?
That's their two names, yeah.
Okay.
So common or southern wildebeest. That's the one we have.
See, I know something.
No, Danny, you know, you impressed me. The fact that you know that there's an eastern and a western one was impressive already. So the eastern white-bearded wildebeest, it's quite easy. What sort of separates the two species is the Great Rift Valley. So on the eastern side of that Rift Valley, you get the eastern white-bearded. White-bearded vulture, because there's a white-headed vulture, so I keep on wanting to say vulture. But white-bearded wildebeest. Anyway, they're both part of the Ugly Five, so at least there's some similarities. Then on the western side of this Rift Valley is where you find the western white-bearded wildebeest. So the eastern one you find in you know, reserves like Tsavo or in the eastern parts of the Tanzania as well, even central parts of Kenya, which is still on the eastern side of the Rift Valley, is where you find these. Then the western white-bearded wildebeest is probably the most well-known one. People just didn't know that's what it was called. But that's the one that does the migration. So the millions you see together, moving from Serengeti to the Masai Mara, that's all western white-bearded wildebeest. They are one of the smaller subspecies of blue wildebeest. So I think they actually are the smallest. They are the smallest of the subspecies, which is quite interesting. Maybe that makes sense why the lions kill so many of them. Because they're a bit smaller and quicker to eat, and then find another one. But anyway, so that's the one you find in the west. Then the Cookson's wildebeest, they are the rarest of all the subspecies and also the lightest color one. In this blog, I know that this podcast is added to our blog as well, so go and check out our blog. But in the blog, there's actually a photo of the Cookson's wildebeest that I got from Johan. You only find them in the Luangwa Valley in Zambia. So you need to get there. If you really want to see the Cookson's wildebeest, you have to go to Zambia, have to go to the Luangwa Valley to see them there. There are some reports that some has ventured off into Malawi. So you might see some in Malawi, but chances are very, very slim.
Yeah.
If you really want to see one, you need to go to Zambia's Luangwa Valley. And then the last one is the Nyasaland wildebeest, which you find in Mozambique and some parts of Tanzania. So they are the easiest to differentiate between all the subspecies because they've got a prominent white stripe across their face. So that's no other wildebeest has that. So if ever you see a wildebeest with a white stripe, that would be the Nyasaland wildebeest. The sad thing about the Nyasaland wildebeest, what they're mostly known for is international hunters. People come to hunt that specific one because it's so unique looking with the white stripe. That's the one that people mostly want to hunt. So when I did my research and tried to look up some photos of them, all I could find is hunters posing next to their trophy, which is actually quite sad. So
that's terrible.
It's definitely not a wildebeest that's known to being photographed, you know, as what we would, you know, trying to get professional, nice photographs of them, which is quite sad. So that wraps up the different species of wildebeest, and that was quite a mouthful. But now, Danny, I think let's sort of talk about what wildebeest are most known for. And we're going to talk about the western white-bearded wildebeest, and that would be the migration.
Migration.
So tell me everything about a wildebeest and its migration.
How long do you have?
All right. We've got time.
Well, the migration, I think one misconception that people have about the migration is that it's just that one part that is happening where they cross the river, get eaten by a few crocodiles, and that's it. And that's the migration. But it's so much deeper than that. There's no beginning or end to the migration. Where it starts, I can't say where it starts, but let's start at a point, and I would say that is in the southern Serengeti. So this is where the wildebeest will give birth. About 8,000 wildebeest calves are born every day between the months of January and February.
That's a lot.
That is about 500,000 calves in that season. It is crazy to think 500,000 little calves running around. But now you must also remember it's tiny little calves. There's a lot of predators, a lot of lions, cheetahs that live on that. That is such an easy prey for them to swoop, knock one of those calves out. But yeah, so that it starts in the southern Serengeti. And what they do in the Great Migration is they follow the rain. They follow the fresh food. The fresh grass. Speaking of the grass, do you know why it starts or why they give birth in the southern Serengeti? Like, why is the grass so good in the southern Serengeti? I just found this out the other day, actually.
Has it got anything to do with rain?
Yes and no. So it's actually about the volcanic ashes from the Ngorongoro crater. Like with the wind, this ashes got transported to the southern Serengeti, the plains close to Ndutu. And that ashes made the soil so rich, and it's like apparently the nicest. Well, we don't know how the grass tastes, but for them it's probably like
the freshest
grass with all this nutrition.
I did not know that. That's very interesting.
No, I found it out the other day. So
cool.
More stuff you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is why they start there. There's a lot of nice nutrition for the calves, everyone. And then they start moving a little bit more north towards the Western Corridor. The Western Corridor. It starts moving towards there, following the rain. After that, they cross the Grumeti River. That's about, let's say, April, May. May is also their rutting season. That is when they start mating. And then from there onwards, they go to the Mara River. It's a split between the Sand River and the Mara River. They cross the Mara River into the Triangle and the National Park, the Masai Mara National Park, feed everything there, cross again over the river, and then back into the Serengeti around about October, November. That's the short answer. Yeah.
And I guess what you touched on there, that's where the saying comes from, the grass is always greener on the other side. I think it's from the migration, because the wildebeest would always think, okay, the rain's there, the grass is greener there. That's why we need to go there.
But that's also one thing, I think, especially that we learned from last year, where the rains were not constant. Mm. It was spread out. Then it rained on this side. Then it rained on that side. It was just chaos.
They just didn't know where to migrate.
They didn't know where to migrate to. So they just kept on looping.
Yeah.
But that's also, the migration is a continuous loop. And within this big loop, there's tiny little loops, like figure eight loops that they go within this massive big loop. That's in short what the migration is.
Yeah. And I think it's getting increasingly more and more difficult to predict where they are, when they are there.
Yeah.
Like you just said, because of the rainfall, and that's due to obviously global warming.
Yeah. I also read a very interesting thing last year on the wildebeest. When we tried to figure out like what is happening with the migration, why is this season a little bit different than the previous seasons that we had? And that is also that they think they've counted wrong. All these years, I think I've mentioned this. If you listen to a podcast that me and Matt Yardley did, I briefly touched on this as well. But they counted wrong how many wildebeest there actually is and how many actually migrates. it was human error.
Wow.
You know, obviously they'll fly over with a plane and they'll do sensors. And there's chances that you double, even triple count a single wildebeest. And that's where you get to 1.5 million wildebeest. Mm. Now they've started to use AI to like count the wildebeest. So they take a satellite photo. They taught AI how to count, like differentiate between a wildebeest and a zebra. Mm. And they count the wildebeest. And they only get to about, I must remember my numbers now. I think it was like 800,000 wildebeest.
Still a lot.
Still a lot. Like when you see 800,000 wildebeest, that's a lot of animals.
No, it's incredible. I mean, it's known as the most incredible natural phenomenon you can see. So the greatest spectacle, wildlife spectacle on Earth. So for great reason. I mean, so tell me the one thing, Danny. I want to know from you. You mentioned in the beginning, which was a crucial point, that the migration is not just the crossing of the river, but that is something that everybody wants to see.
Yes.
And why? How? But tell me more about like the wildebeest and what they need to go through to do that.
So they go through this crocodile infested waters, the steep drops that they have to get through, and then how do you think that they're gonna survive if you stand there? But yeah, they go through this steep drop through the river, and hopefully you get to out on the other side. But this mass of wildebeest, like imagine 5,000, 10,000 wildebeest crossing at the same time.
Yeah.
It's just this absolute chaos of wildebeest.
Yeah. But I mean, like, think about it. When they jump from these steep banks, like, I'm sure you would have seen this. I haven't seen this personally, but you would have seen, like, them breaking their legs and getting out on the other side, lions waiting for them on that side.
No, I think it's such a good source for predators. Crocodiles. I mean, the crocodiles, they feast when it is the crossing season.
No, sure.
Most of them, they'll eat the crossing season and that's enough for them. You have your lions and leopards, your cheetah waiting on the other side for them to cross and take out not even the vulnerable ones, like any wildebeest that they can find. They just take them out.
Jeez, hell. No, it's crazy. But you know what I find the most amazing is how you've mentioned now that January, February, March is when they give birth in the southern Serengeti.
Yes.
And that's obviously when the youngsters are at the most vulnerable time of their life, because they're tiny and they don't know what the lion looks like yet and all of that stuff. So they get predated on a lot. But what I find interesting is that it takes them a good 7-8 months before they get to the Mara River where they're going to cross. So by that time, these youngsters are stronger, they fast, and they're sort of are prepared for this gauntlet that is the river crossing.
Yes.
Isn't it amazing how they don't start in what you said, the Western Corridor? They don't give birth there because that'll be too close to the river.
And, yes.
I mean, that's not why they're not there, but it's just amazing how nature was created in that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, exactly where they should give birth, where the little ones will be.
Yeah.
I would say the safest, because there's still a lot of predators in the southern Serengeti preying on them. But I think that is probably the safest bet. Not, you know, they... when they get to the crossings, they, like you said, they're stronger, they can swim better.
Because for someone that hasn't seen the Mara River, Danny, this river is not like a stream. The current is unbelievable.
It's a proper river.
It's a proper river that has the flow and like I said, the current is so strong.
Yes.
A little baby wildebeest will just flushed away. Like, it won't. So that's why they can't give birth close to the river and let these youngsters cross, because they will just get washed away and they'll drown and die. So it's interesting how that was just a side thought. I mean, magic. All right. So now I want to talk about, and Danny, please chip in here, because this is what's interesting now, is you've spoken about why the wildebeest migrate, and that's they follow rain and they're looking for greener pastures, and that's all great and beautiful. But what impact has that got on the environment, and why is it important that they migrate? You know, and I'm not talking about a wildebeest now. I'm talking about what their role would be within the migration. And I think a lot of people overlook this, but what's incredible about this is there's so many animals, call it 800,000 or 1.5 million, however many they are. They all walk mostly together as a group, obviously quite scattered, but they do walk as a group. And with all of that comes a lot of pooping.
Call it as it is.
A lot of pooping. like a lot. I wish we could, I'm sure some clever people have weighed it in the past, but I mean, I wonder how many tons of poop it is per day.
Oh, my word. Okay.
It must be so much. It's crazy. But that's important because that obviously becomes fertilizer for the soil.
Yes.
And it's so important because everywhere they go, they drop their dung and that's a new little pile of fertilizer. And that just keeps the grass fresh. Another super critically important thing is if you go and look at the Mara and you look at wildfires, especially if you compare it to a place like South Africa or our Western Cape where it's currently burning in January normally, which we are in now, and even places like California or whatever in the States, Australia, grass dries up and then it's very easily flammable and then it wildfires happen, and it spreads very quickly. But because of the wildebeest migrating and keeping the grass short, keeping wherever, you know, by the time the grass is dry, sort of that's fire season is already done. So what I'm trying to say is by the migration happening, they always keep the grass at an optimal level where it's not the best fuel for a fire to continue, which means they actually prevent wildfires in a big way.
It's like a natural lawnmower.
It's a natural lawnmower or a natural firebreak.
A firebreak,
that they keep creating consistently to try, again, they don't know they're doing this, but it helps preventing the fires.
They're not as dumb as we think. You know, they help.
They're helping us obliviously, blindly. They're helping us, or other species actually. And what is also important to note now is because of the fresh grass that they leave behind and that can now regrow after they've eaten it and all of the pooping, the fertilizer that's gotten into the soil, that brings good food for zebra. It brings good food for elephants. It brings good food for black rhino. Well, you know, the shrubs and things in between the grass. So all of that brings great food for everything else. And if the wildebeest are doing well, the zebra are doing well, the gazelles are doing well, everything else does well, things like your lions will do well, your leopards will do well. So it's this whole, everything is connected.
Yeah.
It's just the way nature is. And this is not new for anyone listening. We all know that there's a beautiful system in nature that happens. But I now want to talk about the opposite thing. Let's say the wildebeest stop migrating today. Let's say you and I, Danny, go put up it's currently January, so the wildebeest should be now in the southern Serengeti. Let's say we put up a fence just north of that and I can't go north.
Yeah.
So they have to stay with all of their 500,000 babies now down in the south of the Serengeti, and that's where they're going to stay. 90% of them would die within a year.
Wow.
90% of 800,000 or 1.5 million.
That's
90%.
90%.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
That's a lot of wildebeest.
Most likely the following year, there will be a massive wildfire that will burn down the rest of the food that there is for the other animals.
Yes.
So a lot of other animals will die. In 2 years or 3 years from then, there wouldn't be... The grass wouldn't be nutritional enough. That's not the right word. There won't be enough nutrients in the grass, basically, within 2 to 3 years. So other species will get malnourished and then die.
Outside of our fence now?
Outside of our fence.
Okay.
I'm not even talking about what's happening inside of our fence yet. I'll get there now.
Okay.
I'll get there now. I'm just talking about what's going to happen to the rest of the land.
The rest, okay.
Of the Serengeti and the Maasai Mara. And because of the animals not actually being malnourished and starving, the lions won't have anything to eat anymore, so the lions will die. So again, it's all connected. So if one species doesn't do well, all of the other species won't do well, especially if it's on a scale like the migration. Mm. What's happening inside of our fence, and the reason why 90% of them die, is because now 1.5 million or 800,000 of them are competing for every blade of grass. So there's just so much. So that'll be an area of overgrazing, which also kills grass growth. So that means the grass will stop growing there.
Yeah.
And that means there will be no food for them and they'll die. And then the same thing will happen. The wildebeest will die. Once the wildebeest dies, the lions will die. Everything else will die.
So in short, what you're saying is especially those wildebeest, the Western wildebeest, they are a keystone species for that area.
Every single lion that you photograph in the Mara or in the Serengeti, you have to thank the wildebeest for. If they weren't there, that lion wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating? And I mean, this is true for, again, it's true for elephants in the Kruger National System. If there weren't elephants in the Kruger National System, everything else would die. And it's true for most things. We're just now specifically talking about wildebeest and the impact that they have. I think it's obviously on a bigger scale than what the elephants in Kruger has, because that's a massive area and there's a lot of animals living in there. So very interesting. And I think we've touched on it now, and that's about what do they eat. So they eat grass. This is pretty obvious within this conversation. But Danny, the sort of, you know how their gut system work, they're ruminants.
Ruminants, that's right.
Do you know how that works, or exactly what it is? You don't have to, there's a lot of scientific names within that, but what does a ruminant do?
So they eat, they chew, they swallow, they regurgitate, they chew, they swallow, they regurgitate, they chew, they swallow.
Yeah.
They poop.
That's it. They fertilize, they eat again.
Yeah.
So that system on repeat. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So they eat basically every bite of grass that they take, they need to eat that bite four times.
Okay.
So swallowing, regurgitating, that's just how it works until finally it goes into the digestive system. And the reason they need to do that is to get every single ounce of nutrients they possibly can from every single blade of grass. And that's how ruminants work. And they're not alone in this. There's other animals that are also ruminants, things like giraffe, buffalo, most antelope in general are ruminants. The other kind of herbivore that you get, so you get two, you get the ruminants and then you get the hindgut fermenters, which are things like elephants, rhinos. Those kind of animals are hindgut fermenters and they work slightly different, more like us, but except that they need to eat that same grass that they eat, they need to do that in bulk. So they have to eat a lot of whatever they eat in terms to get that same nutritional value, if that makes sense. Danny, so what eats a wildebeest? So we've spoken about what they eat. Now, what eats them?
Oh, wow. leopards, lions, cheetahs.
That's right.
Crocodiles.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Southern Africa, wild dogs.
That's true.
That's also a good one.
Yeah.
What doesn't eat a wildebeest? That's the question.
Yeah. Tell me about, lions hunting in the migration, for example. How does it work? Is it just like one lion comes up and it just runs into the middle of the 800,000 and hopefully it catches one because one trips over the next one? Or how does it work?
It's very similar to how lions would hunt anywhere else. The one thing is that also, never thought of it, is how short the grass is during that season. Lions use the elements of surprise to hunt where they won't necessarily have that anymore in the big open plains.
Yeah.
But that is where they'll now work as a team, encircle them. The one female takes lead and she leads the hunt, where they need to go, and just hopefully catch them by surprise. And then the other one is, as soon as I cross the river, the lions are there. It's so incredible how the lions know when the crossings are going to happen. Like even a week, 2 weeks before, you can see the lions getting closer and closer and closer to the river because they know the wildebeest are coming. And they sit there and they wait for them to cross.
Well, to be very honest with you, if you've ever sat in the middle of the migration herds, they do smell bad.
And that is true.
So, I'm sure the lions are smelling them from far away.
That is true. Yeah.
So maybe that's why, but that's very interesting. I think what's also just important, one last point that I want to sort of speak about, if you don't mind, Danny, and that's sort of, I've lost my train of thought now. Hold on, give me 2 seconds. Why are they successful as a species? Sorry, that's the point that I wanted to make. I wrote this down here. Why are they successful? Because why are there so many of them? How did the one species, naming wildebeest, how did they become the ones doing the migration, and why are they so successful? And obviously you mentioned it earlier, but I just don't know if all of our listeners have sort of connected the dots that's the reason why they're so successful. And that's because they're seasonal breeders.
Yes.
They give birth at the same time, which you mentioned, January, February, about 8,000 every day for about 2 months. So that adds up to about 500,000 of them. And then obviously a lot of them will get predated on. Mm. Like cheetahs just have a field of a time there. Yeah. Leopards, lions, everything. Even massive eagles can catch a baby newborn wildebeest. So snakes.
Pythons. Yeah,
a lot of pythons catch a little baby wildebeest. So even if, just to put this into perspective to all of our listeners, even if 50% of them get killed, so 250,000 of them get killed, that still means that 250,000 of them survive. That's how many it is.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about it that way. And that's why they're so successful, is because they've got, if a wildebeest had to breed randomly, so one mates now and gives birth 8 months later, then 4 months down the line, another one gets born, so they'll never survive.
No, they won't be as successful.
No. Because it'll be so easy for a cheetah to just catch every single time there's a baby born, just catch that one. But if there's 500,000 of them, not even all the predators can get to all of that. So that's why they're successful. And you mentioned their rutting season or mating season. is in May. This is true again
for
East African ones, the Western and the Eastern wide-bearded vulture again, wildebeest. Jeez, I don't know why it's such a struggle. In Southern Africa, it's slightly earlier. Their rutting season is normally like April, and they give birth end of December. So it's just slightly earlier, by a month or so. But that's why they're successful. And another thing is, if you look at what baby wildebeest look like, they like sandy color.
Yeah.
And this I found very interesting, is like, why are they sandy color? You know, why is there a need for them to look different to the fully grown ones?
Yes.
And that's because exactly that, they look like sand. So if they lie down, because remember in the first 2 or 3 months of their lives, they don't really eat any solid food, it's just milk.
Milk, yeah.
So if they're not suckling, they'll be lying down.
Yes.
And when they're lying down from far away, they just look like little termite mounds. And a pride of lions might just walk past thinking, oh, there's wildebeest on some termite mounds, I'm just going to lay around. And that's also what helps them to be successful, is that the fact that they can blend in a little bit. Danny, is there anything else that you want to mention or speak about in terms of wildebeest?
No, I think we've covered everything.
I think so. If people have any questions about wildebeest, what can they do?
Well, get in touch with us.
Yeah.
Email, Instagram.
Please, or on our website, or read our blog. Go onto our website, read our blog. Like I said, this what we've covered here is obviously a bit more in depth than what our blog is, but our blog also has a lot of info that you can read up about the wildebeest and some nice pictures of them as well. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Danny, thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks.
Sorry that I roped you into this last minute. I'd appreciate
it. No worries. It was a nice chat. It's nice to learn about species that we don't always stop for them.
No.
That's the thing. We drive past just another wildebeest and we drive past them, you know?
Yeah.
And I think as soon as people realize it's not always about the big cats, look into the smaller details as well. And I think wildebeest is one of those. If they're not crossing a river, they're just there.
You're right. I think the longer you look at them, the more interesting they do become. They've got interesting behavior, the sounds that they make. It's all interesting. I think it's an animal worth stopping for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I think we'll do more of this, Danny, this year. I think let's speak about more different species as we go along, and we'll cover some more general game, things like wildebeest in the future, but maybe also some of the high-profile animals like leopards or lions that everybody would like to see.
Definitely.
But let's do all of that. But thanks for listening. Thanks for your time. And I hope that our listeners could get something from this and learn something more about a wildebeest. Please get in touch with us if you want to know more or ask any questions.
Thank Gnu.
Oh, Danny, somebody had to. That is a good one. I have to give that
to you. That's a good one.
Thank Gnu.
Thank Gnu. There we go.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye.